chickens in the houses, they got chickens in the trees, chicken in the pots, the Mottawog, the Petaloomies, out in Petaluma, spending my days. Oh, I'm out in Petaluma, spending my days. Tell me, how many eggs will a chicken lay? Now Marvin got me started, sold me my first hen. Now I got 4 and 20, and 24 more again. I'm out in Petaluma, spending my days. Oh, I'm out in Petaluma, spending my days. Tell me, how many eggs will a chicken lay? Chicken in the morning, it's chicken in the night. Weren't for chicken, Petaluma never would have reached its height. I'm out in Petaluma, spending my days. Oh, I'm out in Petaluma, spending my days. Tell me, how many eggs will a chicken lay?
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, smart talk about food, wine, and farming in Sonoma County, the North Bay, and beyond. We have a really special guest this evening. I am so excited. She belongs right there with Mouthful's Hall of Fame guests, Julia Child, Jacques Pepin, Patricia Wells, Eleanor Coppola, the late Les Blank. Tonight it is Crescent Dragon Wagon, who... You stand over so many different genres, cookbooks, children's books, novels, poetry. You've been an innkeeper, you're a teacher, a chef, all kinds of things. And on top of all that, a beautiful redhead. So it is great to have you in the studio face to face.
Thank you so much, Michelle.
You bet. I'm not even sure where we start. Maybe because the heart of Mouthful has a lot to do with food. Let's talk about the arc. I know that you wrote the commune cookbook, Bean by Bean, which I just love. Cornbread
Gospels.
So let's talk a little bit about that part.
Well, when I was a little girl growing up outside of New York City, I live in Vermont now, but when I was growing up there, that was in the day when phones were still attached. You couldn't walk around with them. And, of course, when you're a teenager, you talk on the phone a lot.
All the time.
And the my family were all readers. And the shelf that the cookbooks were devoted to was right next to the downstairs phone. So as I'm having those eternal conversations you have with your girlfriend when you're a teenager, where you mostly go, yeah? What did he say? I would sort of pull out the cookbooks and leaf through them. And there was a cookbook on the shelf called How to Cook a Wolf.
Oh, yes.
So, and it just drew me in. And of course, it was by M.F.K. Fisher. So I was kind of schooled by the best, because the first food writing that I really read was writing. And, you know, for all the genres that I play in, I kind of believe that good writing is good writing. Mm-hmm. And I had gotten interested in food early because I was a very skinny, otherworldly kind of kid. I didn't like to eat very much. I was very underweight. So the whole block sort of got on a campaign to get me to gain weight and interested in food, and particularly an old lady who lived around the corner named Miss Kay. She baked at home. And I still remember the neatness of when she would measure out the flour and the knife, the flat edge of the knife across the cup of flour to make it even. And many, many, many years later, I would write in a poem for children the following. You put it in wet, it comes out cake. That is why I like to bake.
Oh.
And that, in a sense, sums up my interest in the processes of cooking and indeed of life. You start with one thing and mysteriously it turns into another. And so I cooked with Miss Kay. And then when that was from my earliest days on, and pretty soon I wasn't an underweight little kid. I was average size, and I was eating. She was a person that in 1952 would put pears and blue cheese on her salad. You know, so she was
1952,
and did a very dense chocolate cake that I now know was a flourless chocolate cake. Early, what Malcolm Gladwell would have called an outlier, although she was, you know, an old lady that had been a principal at an ethical culture school in New York. Anyway, so I cooked with her, and she was also a gardener. And those were the days before we had messed around with the sugar content of corn. And you really had to cook the corn, and you had to have the water boiling. And if you picked the corn, dropped it in the, and it was so sweet, it took the top of your head off. The corn that now is, corn doesn't have that thrill anymore.
No.
Because but it's good.
It's different.
It's very different.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I picked raspberries in her. She grew raspberries. She grew corn. She grew some herbs and she cooked. And so, it was experiential, it was relational, and it began to teach me, you know, what I would later come to view as I view food at its best and highest as triangular, three-sided, which we can talk about in a second. But so how I began to write culinary, I always knew I was going to be a writer, but...
When did you know that?
I was telling stories before I knew the alphabet.
Okay.
In my little school, they had, you know, I'm going to make myself sound extremely old. They had hot radiators in New York in the bathrooms, and they didn't have protective things around them. They were just really hot, and you stayed away from them.
Isn't it still like that in New York? I've stayed in a lot of apartments that are like that.
I don't know. In a public school, it would seem to me unlikely, but I remember in the little elementary school bathroom having gathered a group of, and I was telling some fantastic story about witches, and at the high point, I would take a handful of water and say, and then, and I'd throw the water on the thing and it would go, sss.
You know? Early sense of drama.
Yeah, so I was telling stories there. But I guess the bottom line for me is it was always about story or narrative, and I always knew I would write. And from the first, I would write about whatever things were of interest to me. And because I had this early fascination with food, that was one of the things that I was called to write about. And because the first food writer I ever really read was M.F.K. Fisher.
And you can't get any better than
that. You cannot. And so, you know, I don't want to get into too much of a digression, but I'm...
That's okay. It's a mouthful. We digress all the time.
Well, I actually have a learning disability with numbers. It's called dyscalculia, and it's like dyslexia, but with numbers. So I always knew I wanted to be a writer, and my time in elementary school and early high school was basically drumming my fingers, waiting for it to be over. And so at age 16, I left school, and I started writing, and you know, I had sort of crazy bohemian kinds of parents, also writers, although whenever people tell me, it's in your genes, I point out that my one brother is a poker player and a mathematical genius. I don't know how he got in the mix, but maybe a cuckoo brought him, who knows. But so that year I was 16, I went away from school and I wrote and sold my first cookbook. Those were in the days when you could actually send manuscripts in over the transom.
Mm-hmm.
That's a phrase you don't hear much anymore.
So 16 or 17?
16.
Wow. Is that the commune?
That was the commune cookbook.
Wow.
I was living in a commune in Brooklyn, New York. It was 1969. That was the year of great awakening and interest to me. And most of the people there were much older than me.
Mm-hmm. Did you do a lot of cooking in the commune?
I did. And that was where I got involved in natural food, organics, mm-hmm. ecology. I have the distinction of being the first published cookbook that uses the word biodiversity in it. At that point, people...
That's a great claim to fame.
Well, it is. But, you know, like there's, 15 people, probably most of them who live right here in Northern California, that would quite understand why that was. But that was where I started linking together. And it's very gratifying to me now to see Localvore, Organics, you know, all the cornucopia of options that we have now, mm-hmm. that we didn't. But I remember being absolutely stunned and horrified that, you know, what? They feed antibiotics to animals? And indeed, the man I was living with then, who I later married because I was 16, we couldn't cross state lines unless you're married.
That's right.
Even though we didn't believe in marriage because that was the era of that. He was, as I like to say, a sophisticated older man of 28, which seems hilarious to me now at 63. But, he had grown up on a farm in West Texas, and at that point, you know, the system was falling apart, and it was that very first wave of self-sufficiency, what mm-hmm. later became called Back to the Land.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we left Brooklyn, which is where the commune was, and we moved to the Ozarks, and we were working towards self-sufficiency and all that phase of my life, which it could have been another lifetime. I mean, I don't think you have to believe in reincarnation. To believe in reincarnation, you live so many lives in this life.
Absolutely.
And I know that's true of you
as
well. And but so when I was in the commune and, you know, we get the Sears catalog and I look at it and holy moly, there are the hypodermic needles to actually inject the antibiotics into the cows. The cows, and, you know, and it's like, whoa, this is the real thing. And, you know, there were all the Monsanto signs. And so all the things I had been reading about abstractly, I began to see.
Mm-hmm.
And so very early on, I guess that was my area of being an outlier. I was making connections between agriculture, food safety,
mm-hmm. really early on, before a lot of people were thinking about it.
Very early on. But also because I grew up in New York, and as I say, my parents were writers. My father was a wildly adventurous eater. And so, you know, I used to go over to Atlantic Food and eat the Middle Eastern food. And then, you know, you couldn't get hummus at every Walmart in America. You know, it wasn't there.
No.
If you wanted tofu in New York City, you went to Chinatown and you fished it out of the water bucket.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, to go to that idea of food at its best and highest is it's a triangle. And one side is obviously nourishment. And then another side is equally obviously sensual pleasure. But then the third side is that it's the benign medium of contact. I used to say of human contact because I was thinking about parents feeding children and mothers giving their babies breast milk and you know, friends and family. But of course, you know, as my vision widened, it's connection with people that we never even see. People who lived thousands of years ago who saved seed and took corn, for example, much reviled in some circles these days. But, you know, the first corn was the size of a car key and somebody saved those seeds and it got to the mm-hmm. corn that we are. And so the earth, the climate, the air, the water, the people, including those who we will never, ever, ever know. It's connected with the economy, with agriculture, with, which leads me to when I teach culinary writing now, which I teach all kinds of writing. That's one of my, probably my biggest joy next to writing myself is helping people find and tell their own stories. You know, sometimes less now than in years past, people are self-deprecating about being, quote, just a food writer. And I'm saying, well, really?
You know, that is pervasive in our culture. And because a lot of writers will treat food writers that way, well, I found.
And, well, you know, what I would say to those people now, of course, when I was young, I was at Breadloaf for one of those conferences, and I was young and pretty, and the, you know, reigning male deity sort of made some approach to me and asked me, so what genres do you write in? And I said, well, I write kids' books and cookbooks. And his face sort of fell as if deciding maybe I'm not so interesting to come after all. And he says, do you think you'll ever do any real writing? But see, yep. These days, that would not intimidate me for 2 seconds,
right.
Because, you know, there's this unwritten contract when we're born, and that is we eat. We will eat the bodies of animals and fruits and vegetables and their products, you know, the animals that live in the sea, vegetables that live in the sea. We will feast off of those things, which in turn grow from the earth, which is basically decomposed bodies of those who came before, trees, leaves,
everything. Absolutely everything.
And we in turn will be eaten.
Mm-hmm.
So how much more life and death could you be than to write about food if you write about it from a deep perspective?
Mm-hmm.
If you take economy, history, travel, religion, food tells a story in a way that is accessible bite by bite and mouthful by mouthful to every human being pretty much that ever, whether or not they're conscious of knowing it. So those of us who are food writers and really want to be read and want to perhaps change or alter or affect the world, or at least that portion of the world that's our readers, if we're able to look deeply enough, we can emphasize that, you know, yes, it tastes delicious and gives sensual pleasure and nourishes us. And I think too often people divide into camps about, you know, the people that are so in your face about loving bacon. If you love bacon, fine, love bacon. But you can't divorce, you know, food also supports or doesn't support health.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you kind of have to balance both things.
Mm-hmm. I think the other thing we have to factor in there, and some of the things you said, particularly what that gentleman who approached you said about, oh, are you ever going to do any real writing? Do you think that that's rooted in our Puritan history? It seems to me that Americans are so ambivalent about pleasure that's the source of that attitude.
Could be that, and could also be that both kids' books and cookbooks deal with the traditionally female parts of life.
Yes, of course, of course.
That could be. But also, if you think of cookbooks as simply recipes, and you think of recipes as simplistic directions, never mind that the technical writing that is involved in making a recipe, the gold standard of which is reproducible results in anybody's kitchen, I always feel that there's an unwritten contract between everybody who writes or publishes a recipe and every reader that innocently makes it. They assume that, yes, if it says it serves four people are going to be able to, yes, if you do this, this will happen.
Absolutely.
And, you know, so people who do not see that is really a contract, and it's quite hard to write it technologically accurately.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, with the style of the time, the recipe writing style is a little different from the one that I started out with.
Mm-hmm.
In a way that speaks to the level of culinary literacy that people have or do not have at a given time. But let's not assume that. Let's just say that many people think it's just a very simple thing. But if you don't give context and you don't tell story, it's easy to say, oh, that's not real writing. That's just a bunch of recipes.
Right.
And so.
Well, interesting. I want to go back. Just want to stay on the commune cookbook just a little
God.
Bit.
I haven't even picked. That was 1969, babe. That was a while back.
What do you remember about the process? And how did that book do?
Oh, Lord. Well, Simon & Schuster published it. And here's a funny side digression. It went over the transom, and it was accepted by them. And they were just really excited because, I guess, hippies and radicals. I mean, at that point, there was a real gap between those two things. And I definitely thought of myself as a radical, not mm-hmm. as a hippie.
Yeah.
You know, radicals thought hippies smoked too much dope. Hippies thought radicals had no sense of humor. You know, it was a really, the distinction has gotten completely blurred to anybody that wasn't there and lived through it.
We had that going on the West Coast as well.
I know you did. I know you did.
Slightly so different ways.
Your listeners will get it.
Oh, yeah.
But so, you know, I was really in it to change the world and leave it. You know, I was mm-hmm. horrified. I really, frankly, didn't think the world or myself would be here this long.
Mm-hmm. Were you at that time, had you already become a vegetarian?
No, I didn't become a vegetarian until I was about 22.
Okay.
But what I was in my language of the time, I believed that one should not be, quote, alienated, quote, from one's food. Mm-hmm. So, you know, from the time that I lived in the commune in the Ozarks that I moved to when I was 17 with my then guy friend, husband, starter marriage, as people say, you know, I always, but even when I lived in New York, for example, I took it apart intellectually and I thought, you know, it doesn't make sense. There's an irrational prejudice. Why do we eat, you know, the flank or the leg, but we won't eat the organ meats.
Mm-hmm.
So I am a vegetarian who has eaten heart, liver, lungs. You know, I've eaten
tongue,
every organ
kidney.
That there is to mm-hmm. eat. I've eaten it. I've prepared it in my past. And then when I moved to the commune in the Ozarks, you know, I helped slaughter a lamb, a goat. I prepared squirrel. I prepared snapping turtles. God, they're scary creatures. I've eaten groundhog, which is, by the way, of all the wild game.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I can't believe Miss Vegetarian here is telling this, and I have not eaten meat since I was 22. But the groundhog it's the reason why it's called hog. It's very fatty, very pork-like,
uh-huh.
and I used to bake it with like apples and sweet potatoes or something, mm-hmm. you know, very fatty, very sweet. But, you know, so even before, and this, by the way, I will digress to a little, you know, personal pet peeve, which is a personal pet peeve, which is that, that, you know, what you eat is very personal and your choices about it are very personal. And don't make assumptions too much about what other people eat. And my signal example of this is my book, Passionate Vegetarian, was nominated for and won a James Beard Award. And as I was walking that year to
what
the
hotel. What year was that?
Oh, God.
Let's see. Approximately. You would
what ask
decade?
Me that. I believe it was 2002 or 2003.
Okay.
The James Beard and ICP are staggered in a funny way, so I'm never, but it was about that.
Okay.
And so I'm walking to this awards ceremony with my little wheeled suitcase behind me to go check into the hotel. And there outside the hotel in New York, Marriott Marquis, there are PETA people handing out.
I was there that year.
They were handing out the brochures about foie gras.
Mm.
And I sort of raised my hand and I said, You don't need to give me. I'm down for the cause. I'm a vegetarian. My vegetarian cookbook is nominated. And as I'm walking by, I thought, you know, this is really ignorant, because if there are people that are going to get swayed by the moral argument that it's cruel to the geese, which it is cruel to the geese, if they're going to get swayed by that argument, they're not the people that are here. The people that are here know it, and they make that choice ethically. And, you know, I mean, you can make the argument, but you're preaching to the non-choir. They're singing to a different chorus. Yeah. They're singing to, you know, artisanal food. It's, you know, they're singing to small business. They're singing to a very different thing. So I'm thinking, this is so ignorant. You know, why on earth? You know, it's just not thought through. So then I go into the actual thing, and I'm sure some of your listeners have been to stuff like this. And basically, there are little sort of, in effect, food carts set up by whoever the happening chefs are in right. the area that year. And it's sort of like a highbrow feeding frenzy. You know, people are queued up and they want to quick get there something that somebody made. And, you know, but it's a little hard for vegetarians because things are not labeled. So you stand on the right. line for 20 minutes and maybe there's, you know, two pieces of arugula and then it's a pile of prosciutto and you're not going to know before you get there. So I'm queued up to go on the line for the Hudson Valley foie gras, but it comes with a big salad with this seared foie gras on top. And I'm online waiting, and I'm going to have the salad without the foie gras. And two guys are leaving the thing, and one of them is eating it, and he said, this is so good. And he says to me, you have a treat in store. This is the best foie gras. And I said, well, thanks, but, you know, I'm just going to have the salad. I'm vegetarian. And he gives me this very condescending look and says, you don't know what you're missing. And I thought, dude, you are the pet of people on the other side. You're assuming that I don't know jack about foie gras. Have you eaten groundhog?
Really.
Have you rendered duck fat? I did. I raised the freaking ducks. You know, I mean, I did that in my past. So, you know, before we're prescriptive about what other people should or shouldn't be eating or why, you know, we have to consider them as individuals and choice. I mean, we do. You know, you do have to consider things like animal rights, like environmental questions, because the earth is something, it's our home and we all share it and the resources are limited, which is what actually led me towards being a vegetarian, was I had a hard time with the shrinking of resources into, you know, and the Francis Moore LaPay argument that's many years old now. And so that was the thing that first led me into it, was social and environmental reasons rather than animal rights, rather than health. Now, I began to feel more energetic. Not everybody does feel more energetic on a vegetarian
diet.
No,
some people do. Some people get worse. I was a vegetarian off and on for many years.
Yeah.
And I find I actually do better with some animal protein.
And, you know, I'm not a vegan. And so once again, that PETA guy at the Hudson Valley thing comes into play. You know, here I have not eaten meat since I was 22 years old, and there are 17-year-olds vegan that are ready to rip me a new one because I eat cheese.
You know? Or butter.
Or butter or whatever it is, you know. And so, I mean, I think you have to, it's essential to debate ideas and pointless to attack people.
Absolutely. And it's so, once you start thinking about food, and I do think there are a lot of people, especially depending on how they're raised, who simply don't think yet about the source of their food and what it is.
Yes.
But once you start thinking about it, it's so deeply personal.
Yes.
And
yes.
we can't judge, or we shouldn't judge others, you know, until we know, I mean, ever.
Well, and that's sort of what leads me, when I teach my workshop, Deep Feast,
Deep Feast.
Deep Feast.
Great title.
Thank you. Subtitled, Writing the World Through Food Irresistibly. And, you know, what I urge people in is to go deeper, to not do just that fast food writing where you do a sexy photograph and a recipe, and these days online, you do a photograph of the onion, the knife, the chopped onion, you know, the caramelizing the onion at 1 minute, 2 minutes, 5 minutes, 20 minutes. You know, we do it so, you know, holding people's hand through it to,
yeah, that, you know, speed it up thing you can do with GoPro cameras now.
Yeah. But what I encourage people, as I started out by saying, is that food, every food tells a story. It tells a million stories. The universal story is hunger and people satisfying that hunger. Mm-hmm. The, if you want to say the, one step down from universal, well, in a sense it's universal, is you use what you have, the resources mm-hmm. you have, the place that you have informs it. Less so here where we can, for better or for worse, often for worse, we can get everything in season, out of season, everywhere, all the time, 24/7. But, you know, the whole thing of stir fries began with limited fuel and limited time with Chinese peasants. Mm-hmm. So it had to be cut in small, consistent pieces so it could cook quickly over high fuel because they didn't have the fuel to do slow cooking. Mm-hmm. It had to be a la minute. It had to be fast. Mm-hmm. And because people were in the fields most of the time, you know, and it had to be quick. So that whole magnificent cuisine developed through that. And similarly, you know, I live in New England now where the food in general is, you know, underspiced to my taste from the years that I lived in the South. Mm-hmm. Changing now, but still, you know, I mean, even if you go to the supermarket up there, they'll have the pesos picante in mild and medium, but no hot. Not that I'm a big devotee, you know, I'd rather make my own, but still, you know, I just noticed it like, where's the hot? But again, you know, cold weather, no front porch culture, no outdoor cooking, you know, not barbecue. And so things, you were going to have a fire in the wood stove going all day anyway. So you wanted slow cooking mm-hmm. things, the famous New England boiled dinner
absolutely,
baked beans,
yes.
You know, you would have those things that, so wherever you are, that's another universal, but it plays out in as many places as there are in the world that are still connected to that place mm-hmm. and are not in the 24/7 kind of food culture.
Right.
It's really affected by where you are. So I teach people when I teach Deep Feast, I teach, you know, first of all, respect for both the craft and its intent, mm-hmm. you know, that it's deeper than recipes. And yes, I teach the technique of really good, clear recipe writing. One of the great compliments that I get not infrequently when people, you know, in the old days, people would have to write a fan letter to the publisher and they would go to a different department than your editor. And maybe you would get it 3-4 months yes. later. And if you wanted to answer, you would answer by mail and it would, maybe the person would get it, maybe not. These days, people Google you and bam, you got an email mm-hmm. from somebody who said, I just made your white chili out of Passionate Vegetarian, and God, it was the best chili I've ever had, and da-da-da-da-da. But it wasn't really white. It was sort of pink. You know, what is it? Why is it called white chili if it's pink? You know, or whatever question they mm-hmm. have. But maybe once every 2 weeks, I get an email from somebody, and they say, thank you so much for whatever book they've read, Bean by Bean or Passionate V. I felt like you were in the kitchen with me. And that's
such a nice thing.
Really nice. So I encourage people, you know, a lot of people do show off cooking. I'm not a show off cook. Mm-hmm. You know, I gear towards the simple things in my own cooking whose flavors you crave over and over again, not the fancy plated, mm-hmm. not the, you know, vertical plating of 20 years ago, or the, you know, six kinds of puree of rainbow color, you know, that you squeeze out of a plastic. I'm pretty simpler mm-hmm. in it. But whatever kind of food you do, you want to kind of be a reassuring presence to people. Mm-hmm. And it's not, and here's another little story from my past, from when I was an innkeeper.
Was this in Eureka Springs,
yes,
Arkansas?
Yes, I owned a, and it was not a vegetarian restaurant. I was a closet vegetarian at that time. We did serve locally sourced made fish, chicken, and pork, and sometimes rabbit.
Before you tell the story, I should just remind our listeners that you are listening to Mouthful. My guest this evening is the incomparable Crescent Dragon Wagon. Yes, Crescent Dragon Wagon, one of the best names in the universe. Continue with this great story.
And by the way, if they get very motivated, dragonwagon.com is my website. And there is a button that will drop down that says, is that your real name? That will tell the whole story.
It's a great story. It is a great story.
Larded myself with this, you know, or ladened myself with this ridiculous name. Anyway, and have lived to regret it from time to time. I was just late on my plane flight getting out of here. And as I was running through the airport, I heard over the loudspeaker, paging passenger Crescent Dragon Wagon, your flight, the doors are closing in 6 minutes. So as I'm running through the airport, I see all these people who don't know it's me going, here I am spreading sunshine and laughter wherever I go. And when I get to the gate, there are the two people waiting for me, and they both high-five me, say, coolest name ever. It's a relief now that there are younger people who see it as cool name rather than, took too much drugs in the 60s. But, you know, although it is flattering, every so often people will say to me, your parents must have been hippies. That gives you that, oh, gee, I guess I look okay for my age kind of thing. Anyway, so in Deep Feast, which people can also find out about, it's my culinary writing workshop, you know, respect for the deep meaning of the craft and the encouragement and the how-to of finding your own story and vision. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you know, I'm drawing a blank on her last name, Julia. Mm-hmm. She found her thing
We had her on Mouthful.
Well, there you go. You know, she found her voice in doing that. Many people write from their own personal history. I was tickled to see in a recent Food and Wine, they actually did an article on that Minnesotan hot dish, Midwest hot dish, which, you know, for a lot of years, you know, the idea that Food and Wine would have done something on this essentially cream of whatever soup with canned green beans and, you know, fried Durkee's onion rings on top, you know, that would find its way, or the deconstructed, reinvented hot dish. But, you know, food tells one story, hunger, another story, what you make of where you are, and a third story, which is individual, your family, your religious
upbringing.
Who you
are and who you were and how you connected. But I derailed you. I wanted to, you know, you were talking about the restaurant in Eureka Springs Inn.
Oh, I was just going to tell a quick little throwaway story. I lived in Arkansas for most of my adult life. And when I'm down there talking to someone who's, my speech slows. It becomes a little different than it is talking to you here. I get that speech when I'm back there. So I realize to your listeners, I don't sound in the least Southern. But when I'm back there, it just melts.
When I'm
back
there, I sound like a Southerner. It's the easiest accent in the world to pick up. It just sort of bleeds
out
of you.
And it's a beautiful speech.
Yeah, it is. I love it.
I love it. But so, of course, like many chefs, you try to take the regional recipes and flavors and ingredients of your part of the world and contemporize them. And so we had a sweet potato cheesecake that we did. And I did the basic method popularized beautifully by Rose Levy Barenbaum, where she treats it as if you were baking a custard. You know, she does it in a bain-marie, low heat with the. And so the way we did it was that method, and it was a very wonderful, basic, rich cheesecake with sweet potato puree folded in. And what I did in lieu of a crust was I made a giant pecan shortbread. Very standard tea cookie down there. Pecans, of course, are southern nut. And I would score it so you could cut it into little triangular wedges, and you would cut the precise wedge of the sweet potato cheesecake, nest it carefully on the little wedge of crust, so totally crisp. Mm-hmm. Its crust is a separately baked cookie. And that was a dreamy cheesecake. So two nights a week, of course, the restaurant was closed. And one night I was there with a friend of mine. And there was a chef who had worked for us for a while who was trained at one of the great culinary schools. And, you know, it was a sad case. They had led him to think he'd be making $70,000 right out of chef school. And here he was in Arkansas, you know, the great illusion and delusion. But he still had all the, you know, sense of entitlement that mm-hmm. some people leave that with, along with the skills. And so she took a bite of it, and she said to me, "Is Bobby Marks still working for you?" And I said, "No, why?" And she sort of paused, and she let this bite of sweet potato cheesecake melt in her mouth. As I say, this was one of the nights we were closed, and so I was treating her there. She let it melt in her mouth, and she said, "This is so good. It doesn't taste of ego."
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, just offhand in this conversation, look at all the food stories, you know, the commune, snapping turtle, sweet potato cheesecake.
Groundhog.
You know, but you don't have to have lived the life. You can live a very hot dish life and still authentically have food stories to tell. Or you can be someone who has no interest in that side of life, but let's say you are interested in history or patriotism. Why is it as American as apple pie? I don't know the answer to that. I'm just throwing it out there. Mm-hmm. Where I got into that line was in Cornbread.
Yes, your Cornbread Gospels. Love that book.
Thank you. But, you know, I've had two native Arkansasers tell me that they were so grateful to me, a New York Jew, for introducing them to their heritage, because they turned their back on it since it was country and poor, mm-hmm. and it had all those associations. But I was able to come at it just and taste it as food, and only later get really intrigued by, wow, food has a social history, class. Yeah,
social class status. This reminds me of I'll tell this story really quickly. When I was running a restaurant, one of my employees, who is also one of my best friends, was from Mexico City. And I have an absolute passion for true Mexican food. Mm, I love it. And I would often ask her, you know, "I want you to teach me how to make such and such mole. A salsa or whatever." And she'd say, she'd just sort of roll her eyes. Finally, she said, "We didn't eat that kind of food." Her father was a doctor. She went to private school. And they associated what I think of certainly as, you know, I mean, a taco, a real, true, authentic taco is one of the perfect foods in the world. Yeah. Chile verde, so many of the salsas. To me, that's just some of the most vibrant food there is. And to them, that was lower class food. Yeah. They did not eat that kind of food. Yeah. And that was a real lesson for me in the way that there's that social stratification. With diet.
One of my late mother's good friends was somebody who escaped from Soviet Russia, immigre named Joseph Saltzman, who grew up in an upper class Russian family. And he told me that they would always sneak down from the family meals, the beef stroganoffs, the chicken Kievs, to eat in the servants' quarter where they could have kasha. So you see, that's another story that food tells, is social class.
Yeah, if you remember, if you watched in the 70s, Upstairs, Downstairs, one of, just a pivotal moment was when Hazel, who I believe had already married James, has Mrs. Bridges downstairs make shepherd's pie for lunch. I think it was for lunch. It could have been for dinner. And James, her husband, flips out. That is downstairs food. How dare she put something like shepherd's pie on his table? And it made me want to go in the kitchen and make shepherd's pie. So yeah, it's, you know, food and class is so revealing and so important about who people really are. And I think it'll be very interesting to be alive 50 or 60 years from now and be commenting on the food culture of the United States at this time and place.
Well, you know, there's that fabulous book called The United States of Arugula,
yes,
by David Camp.
Right.
You know, it's. I mean, let's hope that 50 or 60 years from now, there is a planet, there is food,
yes,
there is, You know, whenever
communication and thoughtful writing.
Whenever I'm in Vermont this time of year, of course, this when we're recording this, it's early March, and it's the moment of the year when citrus fruits are sublime. Mm. And you know, when I've wintered in Vermont, which I'm not this year, you know, in that white, very cold world, and I get that, you know, pink tinted, yellow skinned grapefruit, and I cut it open, and it's that bright, bright, almost sexual pink, you know, moist,
juicy,
the juice trembling on the little sacks of liquid inside it, sweet, tart, and I'm very conscious it is not local. It had to fly from California usually to get to me. I'm very conscious that the time may come when we can no longer do the insane thing of spending all this fossil fuel import. But I just think, thank you, grapefruit. Thank you for getting here. Thank you, dinosaurs, for being part of fossil fuel long ago. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you, everybody that picked it, everybody that raised it, grew it, you know. And I kind of make that negotiation with myself around eating something that is not local, that is not seasonal to where I am, but it just is sustaining to me. So, you know, I really, in writing about food, I really encourage people to go deep. At this point, there's so many voices clamoring for our attention all the time. And certainly in the food world, there are so many bloggers and writers and videographers. And, you know, so how do you become someone people really want to read and follow and listen to? And so that's what I kind of do in Deep Feast, is I take my principles that I have honed over the years in Fearless Writing, which was written up a little bit in the February, the Oprah magazine.
Yes, where you had that article. And I'm going to post this on Mouthful's Facebook page.
Thanks.
I will post a link to that article about that wonderful artist. Now, you've got something coming up. Is it Fearless Writing in April that you'll be teaching online?
Is,
and we're going to give some special information Mouthful listeners?
It is my course, Deep Feast, Writing the World Through Food Irresistibly. And people can get there if they go to my website, dragonwagon.com, and then they do /mouthful. I decided to do a special thing here. So for those of you that are listening to the tales of groundhog and sweet potato and standoffs with people on either side of the great foie gras divide, you know, those of you that get interested in it and would like to take with me, it's going to be a month-long online course with this, and it'll be every Tuesday night in April, and we'll be together. There'll be a video on.
No, is it a live video?
I'll pre-record it. I'll pre-record the video, but then I'll be around on the phone, and we'll have a teleconference and conversation after each video every Tuesday night throughout April. They'll get if you decide to jump in. There'll be one or two emails a week with reading material, with handouts, with some workbook things, with some assignments. There'll be a private page where people can post their questions, their discoveries, their things they're thinking about. If they like their writing, it can be, you know, the great thing about online teaching is it works for introverts, it works for extroverts. The introverts can just quietly lurk and take it in and be at home and, you know, be in their pajamas and not have to be in front of a group of people where they might get asked questions that would be awkward for them. But the extroverts can, you know, press 6 to ask a question and to jump in and be interacting. And, you know, I mean, the internet was primarily built by introverts who wanted a way to communicate without all having to be in the same room. You know, it just
and I praise them for it.
I do too.
Introvert myself.
It's a cocktail party for introverts. That's what Facebook is. You know?
Yes, it's a great social life. And you can even get dressed if you like to dress.
Because
I love to dress. I just don't want to have to go be with a big group of people.
Well, yeah, it's sort of like, you know, when my mother when my mother lost, when she died at 98.
And that was not that long ago.
That was in 2013. Right. She was a children's book writer. Mm-hmm. And so I was considering different place venues for her memorial. Mm-hmm. And I wound up choosing a church that's on Washington Square in New York, mm-hmm. which mm-hmm. she and my father, as young bohos, lived on Washington Square when it was not the place it is now. And her first book, called The Park Book, was written about Washington Square. Anyway, so I decided I should go to the church one day to see what the feel was like. And they had a part in it where they said every person is invited to come up and share either their celebration or their concern. And one by one, people came up. And, you know, one guy had been diagnosed with AIDS 30 years ago, and he's still here. You know, that was his celebration. And then different people asked people. But whatever their thing was, I thought, huh, this is just exactly kind of like Facebook, is people are sharing their celebrations or concerns. And then I thought, but, you know, you don't have to walk or get on the subway train or go through the snow or get dressed up or sit in chairs or go upstairs. You know, you can, you know, if you're in any way physically, you know, unable to do mm-hmm. that, you can go when you have the flu. It's easy
to still communicate.
And so I talked to a good friend of mine, and I said, you know, I think Facebook, for some people at least, it sort of like fills some of the social functions that going to church does. And she immediately said, yeah, and when you click like, that's amen.
That's great. I love that.
So if people want to come, if any of y'all are interested in doing food writing with me from wherever you are on every Tuesday night in April, and even if you miss one, we send an MP3 the next day so you can download the, you can't be part of the discussion, but you can get the video mm-hmm. or the audio part of the video. And even if you were there, you can listen to it over. And I'm doing a thing on for you all that are mouthful people when you get to the checkout thing.
And it's dragonwagon.com.
Dragonwagon.com. You, when you get to the part where you get to the little shopping cart thing, if it asks you for a discount code, just type in mouthful, all lowercase, and you will get a 20% discount.
That's awesome. Thank you so much.
Cool.
And I'm also going to put that information and the link on the Mouthful's Facebook page. Time flies on Mouthful. We are almost out of it for this episode. What else is on the horizon? I mean, you're certainly doing a lot more with video. Mm-hmm. Any new books on the horizon? Any appearances on the West Coast that we can look forward to?
You know, publishing is the Wild West at this point.
Yes, it is.
And I have 50 published books. They're all traditionally published.
And we should say 20 of those are children's books.
I think about 28.
Okay, two are novels.
Two novels.
Seven are cookbooks.
Is it seven that are cookbooks? How many?
That's what it says on Wikipedia.
It all adds up to 50 somehow. I did a biography of Stevie Wonder. That's another story.
You did? Oh,
yeah,
my gosh.
That's in there, too. Oh, Lord God. As I say, I write about whatever. I have a book of poetry out called Message from the Avocados, written many, many years ago. So I'm at that point where, like many writers, I'm trembling on the edge of self-publishing and investigating that. And,
really?
Publishers are a bit hoist on their own petard.
Yeah.
They have not really been terribly kind to writers over the years. Some have been. Some have done as well as they could within mm-hmm. the system that there was. So, you know, in 2012, I had a cookbook and a children's book come out, Bean by Bean and All the Awake Animals, which is a children's book. And so at the time, I thought, I wonder if these are my last traditionally published books or not. So I'm working on a number of things. I don't ever say what I'm working on because I feel it jinxes it.
I am exactly the same way.
And, you know, it's sort of letting the air out of the balloon.
Sure.
But I'm working and I'm debating how I'm going to publish them. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, I'm continuing to teach not only live and in person as I have periodically, but as you can see, online, because I'm getting older, and so is everybody else.
And that means you're getting wiser, and that's a really good thing.
Well, and it's gotten so expensive for people to travel, and then you add...
And uncomfortable.
And I mean, the same flight that I almost missed, and I heard them calling my name, I was told, get this, that my groin alarmed.
That's right, you told me that.
Oh, for Pete's sake.
You have an alarming groin.
It's like really? Really? You know, that's why I was almost late for the flight, as they had to do this very... Don't get me started on that.
Yeah. Well, you know what? That's a great place to leave us. But with
an alarming
voice. Will you come back?
Of course I will.
Yes, next time you're here, you have an open invitation.
Thank you, darling.
We could talk for hours. And on that note, we're pretty much out of time. So let me just sum up a couple of things. The website is dragonwagon.com, where you'll find everything about Crescent Dragon Wagon. I will also post links and information about the April webinars, debonairs,
20%. Oh yeah, because Siri chewed up webinar and made it debonair.
That will be on Mouthful's Facebook page. And have a great week, and meet me back here next Sunday at 6 for another yummy episode of Mouthful Smart Talk about food, wine, farming in Sonoma County, the North Bay, and beyond on KRCB FM Radio 91.